Good afternoon. This is Bob Krueger with Thought for Food for May of 2019. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully it'll be of interest to everyone. With the coming of spring comes baseball season. For some of us, myself included, baseball is the game, possibly because in some almost forgotten days of my youth, I played the game. No, I wasn't an outstanding player, but I enjoyed the game. As the old Borough Park anthem goes, give me some peanuts and mac and cheese dogs. A new Durham Bull season is upon us, meaning a new lineup of concession creations to eat at the ballpark. This year's roster is led by Southern Delicacies, boundary-pushing hot dogs and waffles used as bowls, the Durham Bulls announced recently. Over the years, the Durham Bulls have built a reputation for testing the limits of ballpark fare, rolling out tater tot waffles studded with jalapenos, tetris-shaped tots for Strange Things Night, and comparatively pedestrian foot-long bacon-wrapped hot dogs. This year's creation includes some mainstays and some limited times offering. You can grab a hot dog topped with mac and cheese and a hot dog with a waffle for a bun at any Durham Bulls game this year, as well as a new patty melt burger and a waffle bowl filled with mac and cheese, grilled chicken, and why not, bacon. There are five limited-time foods, each around for a handful of home games, starting with the home opener on April the 11th. There are fried chicken tenders and biscuits topped with gravy, followed by a sampler of spicy fried foods like jalapeno peppers and onion rings, a spice-rubbed grilled chicken sandwich, a chicken and waffle bowl topped with maple syrup, and lastly, sweet potato tots with pulled pork and nacho cheese. The Durham Bulls are the AAA affiliate of the Major League Tampa Bay Rays. In-house concessions company Bull City Hospitality runs most of the ballpark food, including the gourmet lineup. Beyond concessions, the Durham Bulls also bring back Food Truck Fridays, where two local food trucks will park inside the gates and sell food. Gonzo Tacos, Two Roosters Ice Cream, Pie Pushers, and other local vendors will also be back for another season. New this year is a Yoho Asian Bistro stand. A big question. Do we go to the ballpark to see a ball game or to eat? A lady named B. Wilson writes a column for the Wall Street Journal named Table Talk. In late March, she wrote an article titled A Philosophy of Food as Medicine. Let me share it with you. She begins, "Let food be your medicine," said the ancient Greek physician Hippocrates in the 4th century B.C. But he probably didn't picture a world in which people would feel anxious about their diets, that they would get their DNA sampled before they decide what to eat. Companies like Nutrigenomics and DNA Fit will now test the swab of your saliva for various DNA markers and send you a detailed report on what to consume in order to optimize health for your particular body. Having trouble metabolizing caffeine, reduce your coffee intake. Don't digest dairy well, cut out the yogurt. She continues, "I haven't done one of these high-tech tests myself, partly because I fear the batter will tell me to give up something I love, such as butter. As with so many else in our food culture, the DNA testing feels like a way for consumers who are already super healthy to strive for new levels of perfection rather than an effort to give nutritional aid to people who really need it. Food can be restorative in many ways, and sometimes it's good for our soul to have a slice of cake, whatever my DNA may say. But there are other ways of embracing the idea of food as medicine. The notion of tailoring our food to suit our personal health isn't a newfangled idea, but a very ancient one that somehow got lost in the West. In China, food as medicine isn't something you buy in a kit over the internet, but a way of life that happens in the kitchen. For more than two millennia, Chinese have Eaters have seen food and medicine as two sides of the same coin. All foods can be sorted into Taoist dualities of yin and yang. Yin foods are believed to be cooling, yang foods are to be warming, as well as into one of the five flavors, a pungent, sweet, salty, sour, and bitter. Good health is supposed to be found through balancing these various components. In the West, by contrast, using food as a medicine is still a fringe idea, as the Wall Street Journal reported in October. Some health systems, such as ProMedica in Ohio, are trying to nudge patients into eating well at home by opening food pantries that offer nutritional counseling and healthful fare. But most mainstream doctors still seem keener to prescribe drugs to treat our symptoms than food to prevent us from getting sick in the first place. A few months ago, a relative of mine who lives in the United Kingdom, that's England, was suffering from anemia after an operation. I rang her doctor to discuss whether she should be eating more iron-rich foods in her diet, such as leafy greens, legumes, and red meat, in addition to iron supplements she was taking. "There's no point in that," he told me dismissively, as if it were a strange and backward idea to seek to alleviate a food-related deficiency with actual food. In Chinese medicine, various foods are described for different seasons and different people. Bian Lo, a Chinese food writer, says food was always said to have medicinal qualities when she was growing up. She was taught to look after herself by seeking nourishing foods. "I suffered from yang and therefore had many nosebleeds as a young child, so I was forever being fed with yin, cooling cucumber juice. I was never allowed to eat lychees, my favorite, because they contain too much yang." The ancient precepts of Chinese food philosophy may not hold up to scientific scrutiny. It remains to be seen whether mandarin oranges really do heat the body up or if steamed fish is truly cooling. The real benefit is probably not the specific recommendations so much as the way that they encourage eaters to think about balance at every meal. Vian Lo points out that this medicinal approach to eating is more effective than any other public health directive. She notes that elderly Chinese people tend to eat small amounts of meat and lots of vegetables except at festivals. They had the right idea long before Michael Pollan advised us, "Eat food, not too much, mostly plants." The sad thing is that just as we in the West could benefit from becoming a little more Chinese in our thinking about food and health, the Chinese are becoming less so. The traditional Chinese food culture is being rapidly replaced by McDonald's and KFC, supplemented by a range of expensive superfoods that come with the promise of increased vitality, sexual vigor, youth, and longevity. In a less confused food culture, health food wouldn't be something super that you buy in a special store. It would just be our ordinary nourishment. There seems to be a lot of action taking place in Durham, and here's the latest. Durham's mini golf course and bar has booked its tee time. Bull City Mini owners announced that they would open May the 11th, a.k.a. National Mini Golf Day, in the American Tobacco Campus next door to the Durham Bulls Athletic Park. Bull City Mini will open in the former Bullpen Bar space at 359 Blackwell Street, a shift from the original plans announced last fall. Married owners Julie Bryce and Ben Owens previously said there would be an outdoor course on the lawn by the Aloft Hotel and the Durham Performing Arts Center. Now golf will be weatherproof, 7-hole course with 4 indoor and 3 outdoor holes. A round will cost $7 per person plus drinks. Bryce said Bull City Mini will be on Blackwell Street for 6 months, treating the space as a pop-up trial run for a possible larger course at a later date. Our ultimate goal is to be open 10 months a year with a larger course of 18 to 27 holes, Mr. Bryce said. We'll test the idea and get feedback and then hope to be open in a more permanent setting. Holes are designed by community members from artisans to middle schoolers, and even Duke University medical students after a contest last year. Bryce said 50 entries came in, each bringing some aspect of germ to life. They were ultimately whittled down the entries to 7 holes, with a handful of others set aside for possible expansion. One hole immortalized the infamous Can Opener Bridge in Durham. Mr. Bryce said, known to shear off the tops of 2 tall trucks. There wasn't a bad design in the bunch, Bryce said. Everything was so local and so inventive, and really show a love of Durham. For the bar, Bryce promised high and low options with local beers from Brewery Bahavana, Full Stream, and Polisaris, but assures that Miller's High Life and the PBR will be available as well. For wine, they'll offer inexpensive options that can pass the snob test, adding that wine is her preferred drink. From there, it gets funky. Bull City Mini will have a froze machine pouring out frozen rosé and a sparkling wine cocktail topped with locally made cotton candy from a Raleigh company, Wonder Puff. The Mini Golf Bar follows a trend in Durham nightlife, combining games and chance and skill with a few beverages. Winners of the whole design contest were paid $500 and given passes for the course for family and friends. And while we are in Durham, we will be passed along this story. Durham Technical Community College plans to open a new culinary arts program at the American Tobacco Campus in downtown Durham. Durham Tech's new program will take over part of the space of the former Art Institute of Raleigh-Durham, which was vacated last year. The Art Institutes of Raleigh-Durham was one of the several for-profit schools owned by Dream Center Education Holdings to close last year when Dream Center suffered serious financial and accreditation issues. Durham Tech will lease classroom and commercial kitchen space on the first floor starting in June, a spokeswoman for the community college said. The new culinary program will start classes in the fall and will offer the school's first associate degrees in culinary arts. Before now, Durham Tech only offered continuing education culinary courses in which students could only receive certification or take one-time courses. Durham Tech said placing the program in downtown Durham, a hub of the Triangle's thriving food scene, would create a number of partnerships with local restaurants. While not many of us will be taking a plane ride anytime soon, it's interesting to learn how much food is available at the Raleigh-Durham International Airport. They lost a burger restaurant when 5 guys closed in February, but another will open its place this summer. BurgerFi, the 8-year-old chain based in Florida, is scheduled to begin serving burgers, hot dogs, and frozen custard in Terminal 2 in July. It will be at least the 4th BurgerFi in North Carolina after restaurants in Raleigh, Cary, and Hickory. Sales at the RDU 5 Guys were on budget, said Lena Kramer, the spokeswoman for SSP America, the company leasing the space. But SSP thinks it'll do better with BurgerFi, Kramer said, in part because the restaurant will sell beer, wine, and mixed drinks. BurgerFi gives us an ability to add a bar, which we felt was an added service that RDU passengers would welcome. SSP operates bars, restaurants, and food markets in airports around the world, including Jason's Deli, next to the old 5 Guys space. The BurgerFi at RDU will be the company's first, Ms. Kramer said. BurgerFi is what is known as a better burger restaurant, often mentioned among chains such as Smash Burger, Shake Shack, and Umani Burger. It features fresh, high-quality beef and high-end accessories such as brioche buns and hand-cut fries, as well as prices 2 or 3 times higher than the more ubiquitous fast food chains. SSP has found that airline travelers are more likely to treat themselves and are looking for more than a Whopper or a Big Mac at the airport. Better burger is obviously a huge trend, Ms. Kramer said, and we're always looking for burger partners because it's one of the top-selling items in the airport environment. 8 other restaurants now also serve hamburgers at RDU, including ACC, American Cafe, and Char Grill in Terminal 1. At last, grocery fans who've been waiting for years for Wegmans to come to this area finally have a date to circle on the calendar. The Raleigh Wegmans Food Markets will open at 7 a.m. on Sunday, September 29th. It's the first North Carolina location for the grocer with a cult-like following. The store will be located on Old Wake Forest Road down the street from Trader Joe's. Wegmans is known for its bread baked fresh daily, fresh seafood, take-home meals, an international food selection, and elaborate cheese shop. The store also includes the Burger Bar, an in-store restaurant that will sell sandwiches, soups, salads, beer, and wine. The 104,000-square-foot store will hire about 475 employees. About 150 of them will be full-time. Applicants can apply at jobs.wegman.com/Raleigh or can call 948-960-5588. 948-960-5588 for more information. The company offers full benefits, including medical and dental insurance, a 401k plus a separate Wegman retirement plan, paid time off, and tuition assistance to full-time employees and part-time employees averaging 30 hours a week. The Raleigh Downtown Farmers Market is going through big changes for the second year in a row as new location, name, and hours set for this summer. The popular market will relocate a block over from Fayetteville Street to City Market in June, and then the new Morse Square Park. The updated park opens, the Downtown Raleigh Alliance announced recently. While previous markets may have held midday to capitalize on the lunch crowds, this year's market will open from 4 to 7 p.m. Last year, the market had a new home, having moved from its longtime City Plaza spot further up Fayetteville Street to the corridor surrounding the new Pointer YMCA. Reflecting the move, last year's Market on Market will be renamed Moore Square Market. David Moore, the placemaking and activities manager with the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, said the new location will allow the market to grow. It will also have restrooms and designated parking. The new space will definitely allow us to accommodate more vendors, he said in a telephone interview. At the last place, we were able to accommodate about 20 vendors, and at Moore Square, we're hoping to do 20 to 25 each week. The market will open from June 5th until October 16th. For the month of June, it will be housed in City Market across the street from Moore Square. On June 26th, it will move to Moore Square. Moore Square Park is currently undergoing a major facelift with the addition of an events space, cafe, and bathroom, among other features. The Moore Square Market will continue to have themed events, including Tomatolicious and the Honey Festival, which have been favorites in previous years. There will also be live entertainment and craft vendors, as well as a way to highlight nonprofits. The market will partner with Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina to keep their EBT food stamp program for the year. This will allow anyone who has EBT or SNAP benefits to attend the market and purchase items there, he said. We'll do a $10 match. So if a customer has EBT or SNAP benefits and spends $10, we'll give them another $10 to spend at the market. For more details, go to RaleighHeatLocal.com.food. A nonprofit restaurant, A Place at the Table at 300 West Hargis Street in downtown Raleigh, is about to double in size, potentially doubling its impact on the community. The Pay What You Can restaurant is just over a year old, but it announced plans to add more seating, a new kitchen, and event space by moving into the former Alley Boutique space next door. We're humbled by how generous Raleigh has been, first in helping us to open in 2018, and since then through grants, daily volunteer shifts, and simply making a place at the table your destination for breakfast and lunch, founder Maggie Kane said in a news release. We're grateful they're playing a part in helping us to achieve our goal to make sure everyone in the community has a place at the table, she said. A Place at the Table opened in January of 2018, serving breakfast and lunch 6 days a week. Ms. Kane told the News and Observer that this new work is expected to be finished by August, bringing the total seating to around 65. The model allows diners to pay the full price, pay as little as half if needed, pay it forward, or pay for a meal with an hour of volunteer service in the restaurant. So far, more than 9,000 meals have been given away to people in need. Kane was the News and Observer's January Tar Heel of the Month. Then she told the NNO that she often is asked about adding locations around the Triangle and beyond. The doubling of the Hargis Street location may be the closest to that sort of an expansion, extending a place at the table into neighboring space and growing the restaurant's footprint. There will be additional indoor and outdoor seating as well as a more professional kitchen. In its first year, A Place at the Table made breakfast and lunch with a waffle maker, a sandwich press, and an oven. An expanded kitchen will allow more freedom on the menu and enable the restaurant to realize the full potential of how A Place at the Table can serve the Raleigh community, Ms. Kane said. The restaurant said the expansion will cost around $100,000. About 75% of that amount has already been donated by the nonprofit's corporate partners. The Place at the Table is also adding a restaurant advisory board with its longtime restaurant advisor, Sean Degnan of Buque and Socra, who is chair of the longtime cafe's board of directors, and acclaimed Raleigh chef Scott Crawford of Crawford and Sons. We see ourselves as a restaurant contributing to Raleigh's thriving scene as much as a destination for those who are food insecure, she said. At times, in the new scientific techniques bother me. And here's such an example. Hembert Figueroa just wanted a taco, so he was surprised to learn that the dollar bills in his pocket were no good at Dos Toros Taquera in Manhattan, one of a small but growing number of establishments across the United States where customers can only pay by card or smartphone. Cash-free stores are generating a backlash among some activists and liberal-leaning policymakers who say that the practice discriminates against people like Figueroa who either lack bank accounts or rely on cash for many transactions. Figueroa, an ironworker, had to stand to the side holding his taco until a sympathetic cashier helped him find another customer willing to pay for his meal with a card in exchange for cash. I had the money and I couldn't pay, he said. This issue got some high-profile attention this week when retail giant Amazon bowed to pressure from activists and agreed to accept cash at more than 30 cashless stores, including its Amazon Go convenience stores, which have no cashiers, and its bookshops. Amazon declined to say when the change will take place. There is no federal law that requires stores to accept cash, so lawmakers are working on the issue at the state and city level. Earlier this year, Philadelphia became the first city to ban cashless stores, despite efforts by Amazon to dissuade it. New Jersey passed a statewide ban soon after, and a similar ban is working its way through the New York City Council. Before this year, there was only one jurisdiction that required business to accept cash. Massachusetts was passed one nearly 40 years ago. The potential societal cost of a cashless economy, I think, outweighs the potential benefits for business, said Richie Torres, a New York City councilman for South Bronx, who introduced the bill. Policymakers argue that while cashless enterprises aren't widespread now, the practice could expand to more services, including some that cater to low-income people. Walmart-owned Sam's Club opened its first cashless store in Dallas last year, using technology that allow customers to scan and pay for items with their smartphones. Kroger has installed similar technology in about 400 stores nationwide. Stadiums in Tampa Bay, Florida, and Atlanta have started to go cashless or nearly cashless, and the Barclays Center, where the Brooklyn Nets play, is now effectively cashless as well. Advocates for cashless bans worry that technology is moving too fast for the 6.5% of American households, some 8.4 million people, who do not have a bank account, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Figueroa is among the much larger group considered underbanked, meaning they have a primary bank account but regularly rely on alternative financial services like check cashers. More than 24 million U.S. households are underbanked, according to the FDIC. Figueroa, an immigrant from the Dominican Republic, only opened a credit union account 2 years ago. It took another 2 years to build up enough funds to use his debit card regularly. He still occasionally relies on a check cashier if he needs money quickly, and much of his income comes in cash from his weekend job as a busboy. He has no credit card, no apps on his phone, and has only shopped online 3 times. Business owners who go cashless say they are following the lead of the majority of customers who are abandoning cash payments. Retailers are under pressure to cater to customers with heightened expectations of fast and seamless service driven by companies like Amazon, Uber, and Grubhub. Leo Kremer, co-owner of Dos Toros, said the volume of cash transactions at his stores fell from about 50 persons a decade ago to 15% last year. That made the cost and logistics of handling cash especially onerous. There are no bad guys on this issue. Everyone is trying to do the right thing and make sure there are no unintended consequences, he said. Critics say banning cash-free stores is overreaction. There's no overall estimate of how many U.S. stores have gone cashless, but it remains a rarity. In New York City, the trend appears to be gaining traction, mostly with fast casual dining establishments like Dos Toros. Far more common are stores that require a minimum purchase for non-cash payments. To call this a trend is a bit of an exaggeration, says Craig Shearman, a spokesman for the National Retail Federation in Washington. That's not something the average customer would expect to see at every store at the mall anytime soon. In testimony to a New York City Council committee, Mr. Kremer argued that businesses that consistently serve the unbanked and underbanked population aren't going to go cashless. It wouldn't make sense for them. But financial experts who work with low-income people caution against making assumptions about shopping preferences or buying power or those who rely on cash. I'm uncomfortable with the idea that certain people can't shop here, so it's fine to exclude them, said Justin Zinkin. We've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. Be sure to listen in next time at this time. We're hoping you've enjoyed it. I'm Bob Kruger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 9.